The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. Can people hear okay? Loud enough out there? So happy Mother's Day. There's a long tradition in Buddhism of saying that the wisdom is the mother of all Buddhas, that the Buddha had a mother and was wisdom. So for all the wisdom of all the mothers and women and generations who've helped us all out, thank you for that. So also interesting, maybe, I don't know if it interests you, but this word that's very important in our tradition, sati, usually translated as mindfulness, in the Pali language, it's a feminine word. So, have you ever wondered about the gender of what you're doing? So, one of the important teachings or insights of Buddhism has been that into what's called not-self. And it's a teaching which has confused a lot of people. What self realizes not-self, for example. And I want to read you a passage from a kind of academic article by a European scholar, a woman named Joy Manet. And she was at a conference where some therapists were confused by this issue as well. At a recent conference, whose theme was the psychology of awakening, Buddhism, science, and psychotherapy, many of the participants expressed their confusion regarding how the Buddha could function in the world without a self. Because they were Buddhists, they were trying to follow the teaching and to achieve or to imitate what they imagined this form of functioning could be. I thought they had missed the point. What the early texts show in the character of the Buddha is someone with a very advanced self-concept. His self-esteem is perfect. He has gone beyond doubt. He knows. He is confident of his knowledge. He expresses himself with conviction. When the Buddha talks of himself in the first person, he does so with clarity. He has a strong sense of identity and knows very well who he is. He gives accounts of his life experiences in the first person. He gives accounts of his spiritual capacities in the first person. That is, he announces and proclaims that he is a Buddha and says what a Buddha is. He gives first-person accounts of the capacities required of him by society. That is, he insists that he is a competent debater. He discusses at ease and full equality with kings and other notables. He defends himself and his teachings against unjust accusations and false representations. It is clear that the Buddha's self, as this concept is understood in contemporary psychology and psychotherapy, namely a clear sense of identity, the ability to function competently and realistically in the world, to have a standard of ethics, to achieve one's goals, to interact with people, to make good choices, and so forth, was fully functional and remarkably well-developed, as one would expect. Neither psychotherapy nor meditation is possible unless the sense of identity or ego is mature and well-grounded. Otherwise, there is nothing to change, nothing to go beyond. So the idea of the Buddha as a confident individual, self-assured, capable in the world, clear sense of who he is, who he was, and have a clue who he was in relationship to other people, does go against the notion that some people have about the goal of practice that's meant to make us self-effacing, that kind of soft, accepting, not really there, kind of, you know, so empty that everything goes, everything's fine, you're not troubled by anything. And here you have someone who is comes across, the way Joey Monette talks about him, as, and I would concur based on the, what I've read in the suttas, of someone who is certainly not self-effacing, certainly not very present and engaged and self-confident. But it's also someone who is liberated. So the question is, what is the relationship between being spiritually awake or spiritually liberated and this whole concept of self that many of us wonder about or struggle with? It's considered one of the great personal and philosophical, psychological issues to come to terms with what is self, who are we? I think that in this early tradition, the question, who am I, or what is yourself, is not the starting point, not the question that the tradition tries to answer. Instead, it tries to answer some other questions. And one of the questions, I think, maybe it's not explicit in the text, but maybe it's for our purposes we can raise it, is what is freedom? What is it to be psychologically or spiritually free or awake? And the contrast for freedom is to be caught up. I think in the ancient world, they used the language of being enslaved, being in chains, chained down. So not enslaved or in chains by the world around us, but rather by the functioning of our own minds with our fears, our desires, our hates, and to be caught in the vice of our preoccupations so that there is no freedom of movement within us. And if we look at the movement, you know, the possibility of freedom, and in doing that see how we're caught, that's the beginning of wisdom. That's the beginning of a very important movement in Buddhism. It's been said sometimes there are three great movements about kind of resolving the issue of self. One movement is kind of a movement of regression, to move back into some kind of some kind of childhood notion of innocence where everything is fine and wonderful, or take refuge in something that feels infinitely pleasant and enjoyable, where there's no problems, kind of in a cocoon. And I've known people who have had very traumatic lives, and their way of coping with it has been to pull back away from the world and their difficulties and take refuge in kind of altered states of consciousness or states of quite disassociated or removed, sometimes where there's a lot of bliss, a lot of feeling of emptiness and separation. But there's no wisdom there. It's mostly receding into something. It's a kind of pleasure, safe place. So that's one way. The other way is to find or claim that there is some real essential self, like a soul, a permanent, abiding, true thing, and that becomes a place of security, a refuge, a place. And again, if there's a lot of insecurity in a person's life, it can be very reassuring to finally kind of lock onto a clear sense of strong identity. This is who I am. And so we have religious traditions that will emphasize that. We have to realize the true nature of self and who the true self is. The Buddhist approach is neither of those two, but is rather to cultivate and develop a strong sense of self, a strong capacity, inner capacity. The ancient tradition does have the phrase to develop a strong self and to make the self an island, to make a self a refuge for yourself. The ancient Buddha wasn't shy about using the word self. For all the teachings of not self, the word self was used. You know, make an island of yourself, become a great self. They use the word great self, which is nowadays, we know it as Mahatma, Mahatma Gandhi. That title means a great Gandhi, the great self. And so to develop oneself, but in the process of doing it, acquire wisdom and understanding about how we get caught and what's on the other side of being caught, how to be uncaught. So this movement, this third movement of Buddhism, is requires us to begin understanding how it is we get caught, what goes on in our minds, not to recede away from that, be protected from it, or not to ignore that in some way so that we can hold on to something, but really to understand the fears, insecurities, the attachments, the concerns by which we hold on to something really strongly. And if we're caught and understand how we're caught, and then we can let go of that or overcome it, then we're someone who is no longer caught in the vice of self, no longer, trying to prove something, conceit, and a variety of ways. And then the question is, what is self? Who are you? Has a different emphasis, a different importance in a person's life. Because if you're now free from being anybody, maybe it doesn't matter who you are in some kind of essential way. Or you don't have to protect yourself away from the conventional ways in which we are in the world. So an important part of this Buddhist tradition and part of the function of something like mindfulness and meditation is not to go in the rapid approach into the deep states of bliss and calm and, but rather to go into it, certainly in its own due time, but to do so in the process of doing that, then with that as a support, begin understanding what the mind does, how we limit ourselves by the ideations, the attachments, the ideas that we have. So sometimes it's easy to see how this operates, but sometimes it's easier to see it kind of almost externally. Some of us, probably most of you, have had the experience of someone seeing you in a limited way, seeing you as, in some category, because if you're seeing you only through the profession or seeing you only through the lens of something you did once upon a time, and that's they limit you by that thing, or sometimes by you're someone's spouse, and so they see through that lens and they can't see you beyond that, or your ethnicity or your class or your race or something. You kind of people are limited by how people are people limit you. And sometimes you really feel that limitation. It doesn't feel good to kind of be put in a box. It's also sometimes easy to see how other people do that for themselves. Sometimes I've kind of just wanted to shake people, shake it out of them, because it's so clear that they've restricted their sense of self, their self-concept, in such a dramatic way that they're really, boxed in a prison almost of self-concept, self-ideas. One of the ones that I just finished teaching a retreat, 7-day retreat, and the one that I saw repeatedly among a number of the people at the retreat was this self-concept that they're not good enough. And I was really impressed how deeply embedded in the psyche was this notion, this conviction that I'm not good enough. This is the nature of the universe was built so that I could exist as someone who's not good enough. It's like, this is like locked in, the operating system of the universe. And if you scratch the surface, you go into, where that comes from, some of them it was really clear that it was something they learned from their parents, very critical parents who kind of actually told them, you're not good enough. Some of them, their form was, yes, you did great, you got an A, but you needed to get an A+. You're not good enough unless you get an A+. And so they grew up with this idea of never good enough, never good enough, never can live up to the standards of their parents. And then some of the people I talked to was because of their religious upbringing. They had a certain religious environment where the lesson was so powerful was it's somehow you're not holding up to some kind of standard that you're expected to do. And sometimes it's because the situation in growing up was so difficult for people, so painful. And then they internalize the cause of that pain. Young children often will take responsibility for things which are not their own. I once, when I was 6 years old, brought a pole back to my neighborhood, and it seemed like a long pole. And so later in the day, some adult picked up that pole and tried to pole vault over a little picket fence. And in the process of doing that, he broke his leg. And I was to blame, obviously, I caused that. I brought that pole. So 6-year-old mind, cause and effect. So it's easy to kind of say, I'm not good enough, I'm responsible, I'm bad. And so these things sometimes get locked in at a very early age. And or when I was in seventh grade, it never caused me any suffering, this one, but because I just took it as true. I was at an art class, and I was drawing, and the art teacher came over to me and said, you have no artistic ability. And since I didn't care whether I had or not, I had no identity around that, particularly, it didn't matter to me. But she was the authority, so it must be true. So I just put on that piece of clothing, and happily, still didn't care. But I just, that's the, one of the self-concepts that I carried with me into being a freshman in college. And then I was, my roommate in college was a born-again artist. And so by the end of the school year, he had converted me. And it turned out I had some artistic ability. And so... then I remembered how, one of the reasons I didn't pick up a pencil to draw was because of this teacher, what she told me. So this idea of being limited, it's much harder to see it for oneself, to see how we limit ourselves. And part of the function of meditation practice is to help us to see that. And the unfortunate part of seeing that, more often than not, is we see it in how we hurt. That a lot of the suffering and pain that people experience has its a connection to our self-concept that we're carrying with us. It plays out in a variety of ways. The concept we have that's threatened, the concept that we have that we're trying to prove to the world, concept that we have that can be frustrated, the concept that we have that that's not being supported by others, the idea that we want to be seen by other people. It isn't just the concept that we have for ourselves, but there can be a tremendous amount of social gymnastics that goes on to try to ensure that other people see us the way we want to be seen. It's been said that some people are more careful with the clothes they choose to dress in than the words they speak, because of this idea of the clothes. Kind of you're presenting yourself to the world. People are seeing you in a certain way. So this is the bad news about Buddhism. Is that part of Buddhism is this honest assessment, honest looking at yourself and seeing how all this works. But not to rub salt in a wound or make it worse. And this is, we have to be very careful in Buddhism when we kind of have this honest looking at ourselves, that we understand that the context for that looking is one of caring, of compassion, of kindness to the, and also the sense of possibility. And part of the possibility is to dwell in the world with confidence, with efficacy, with strength, as the Buddha did. In fact, it's been some people who've studied the teachings of the Buddha have described it as a path of power, because of the tremendous self-confidence and strength that's cultivated and developed along this path. The Buddha was explicit about the cultivation of bala, of power. So it's a little bit different than the idea of kind of being, kind of empty and not really there. Perhaps someone who's free is really there in a powerful way. It's a sense of presence is quite strong. The one way that the early tradition talks about self or citta or the mind is that the mind can become boundless. That there doesn't have to be any limitations on our sense of self. Doesn't have to be limitations on the mind or awareness. And when there's no limitation, maybe we don't have to be anything for anybody. There's nothing to prove anymore. But it doesn't mean that there isn't a strength in that presence. So I think the part of the reason this is important, this idea, is that if we don't understand that strength of capacity and developing ourselves is an important part of the tradition, it's possible to overlook that side. And sometimes when Buddhist practice is offered or presented mostly as acceptance, accepting yourself in a deep way, everything's okay about you, you're fine, you are enough. You're so enough, you don't have to do anything. Just accept yourself and everything will be wonderful. That then there is no development of strength, of inner core. And then perhaps you just need to be reassured over and over again, or put in a situation where everything is safe, where you can kind of accept. But it isn't just a matter of having a safe environment. Buddhist practice is help. We want to be able to cultivate ourselves so our safety is portable, that we carry it with us. Because I think it's unrealistic to expect that we can go into the world and always have it a safe place. But we can bring our safety with us, and part of that is our inner strength, our capacities that we cultivate and develop. Part of it is our self-understanding that we bring with us. Part of it certainly is our ability to let go of ways in which we get caught and hold on. And part of it is our ability to have empathy and clarity and be able to communicate in effective ways. So, one of the remarkable things when you read these ancient suttas is when the Buddha was challenged by people, and he often was, he seemed to be unfazed by that challenge. He seemed to be very direct and involved in the challenge, but he seemed to stay peaceful and free in the middle of it. One of the aspects of this teachings of not self or connected to it is the teachings around conceit. Self and conceit maybe can be seen as two different things, but part of the function of the path of practice is to lower the flag of conceit. And holding up your flag and say, look at me, this is who I am, is a form of suffering. And it certainly can be suffering for you, and too often it's suffering for other people as well. or at least an irritation. But to lower the flag of conceit. And so what's that juxtaposition of having a strong sense of confidence without it being conceit? Some people are afraid of being confident because it can look like conceit, and the last thing you want to do in a Buddhist community is to have conceit, stand out in some way. But I think that being willing to be yourself in a confident way is a result of doing this practice. And one of the, I think it's Jack Kornfield who said, the more mature a person becomes in this practice, the more eccentric they become. So, we don't advertise that. No one would come. Come and be eccentric. Make it more people. And I think what's implied by this idea is not that you're supposed to be, eccentric in a crazy way or something, but the eccentric in the sense that you become more yourself and more completely yourself. And maybe some of you, are actually would be naturally more eccentric if you just allowed yourself. Weren't trying to fit in and be nice and have no one criticize you and be safe and protected. You would be more expressive or different in some way. And that's certainly my hope of Buddhist practice in a community like this, that everyone can just be more themselves. And it's hard whenever you're in a community to be that completely, because a community has certain kind of, ideas of how you're supposed to be. And then people are kind of looking, how am I supposed to be here, and what's accepted, and what's approved of, and then they look towards the teacher for what's the right way, and heaven forbid they look at me, to see how you're supposed to be. I'm eccentric enough. I'm kind of an odd guy, I think. So the idea is to kind of, find out what limits you, and if you're looking towards someone else about how to be, is it supportive for you to do that? Sometimes it is supportive. You see someone else and you're inspired by that. Oh, I can be that way too. Or, this is meaningful for me. Now I can be that way because I see that it's allowable. And sometimes you see how you look towards other people and it actually kind of narrows you and makes you smaller in the process. So how do you, what goes on? This has to do, again, the self-understanding. Always come back. What goes on in my mind? What are my interests? What are my motivations? What are my reactions? What's going on here? So we become our own teacher, so we can understand how all this works. Without the wisdom of that, I think there is no possibility or freedom. Some people want a freedom that's kind of handed on a silver platter. Some of the idea of instant enlightenment, the Big Bang theories of enlightenment, more often have to do with a wish that of sidestepping all the whole process of self-understanding, to understand how clinging works, how attachment works, how selfing works, and just going to get to the other side without any, you know, having to do any work. I think this slow process of self-understanding is very, very important. So one of the possibilities in relationship to the sense of self is to develop this stronger self, what we can call self-understanding, in the sense that we understand what our reactions are, we understand what our emotional life is, we understand what our thoughts are, we understand what our beliefs are, we understand what how we see other people and our response, reaction to other people. And there's a tremendous amount of understanding of the details of how all this stuff works in this psychophysical being that's here. And in a conventional way, we realize very clearly that if I have an itch, it's my itch. If I have an itch, I don't scratch someone else. Or if I pee, if I need to pee, I don't ask you to do it. You know, some things that you have to, you know, you understand where, you know, there's a self-reflective understanding of where the domain of responsibility is, where the domain of experience is. That doesn't disappear. However, what can happen is that the sense of boundary, the sense of fixity around that self-reflection can disappear. So that nothing sticks, or it's just open and porous. So the sense of awareness, sense of presence, sense of beingness doesn't have anything, any place that, you know, that's congealed, that's static, but rather it's open and fluid. And so, you know, it's kind of like the playground thing, you know, sticks and stones cannot... Sticks and stones, how's it going? I don't remember anymore. They can break my bones, but words can never hurt me or never touch me. So there's an understanding that certain things, words, what people say, many of the experiences in the world, and can't touch me, which I think is the Latin meaning of the word integrity. Isn't that interesting? To have integrity is to have something that can't be touched. So to not be touchable, so in, not because there's some core essence of who we are that's protected, but rather because there is no core essence that we can find. And whatever happens to us doesn't land anywhere. It just goes through. It doesn't stick anywhere. The one of the exercises I sometimes will give people when I'm meeting with them is they're talking about some difficulty they have in the world, and I kind of hold up my hand flat to kind of vertical way, and I say, there's two ways that this thing in the world can approach you, reach you. One way is it can reach you and hit you like a wall, hit something inside of you. The other thing is that it just goes right through. It doesn't hit anything. So when you're having trouble with this issue in the world, I ask them, what is it it's striking inside of you? What does it hit inside of you? And this is part of the thrust of Buddhist practice, take responsibility for where it hits. What's the reaction? What's going on here? And oftentimes, it's very easy for us to blame the world outside for our reaction. So for a very simple one was, you say, you made me angry. No one makes us angry. Someone who has the self-confidence of a Buddha, perhaps, someone who's fully here in a strong way and knows themselves well, will not blame anyone else for being angry. That person might have created the conditions for your anger, but if you're really very present and have a self-understanding, you see that someone did something, said something, That experience was received in your body and mind in some way that was, to make it very simple, usually more complicated than this, but it was deeply unpleasant. And in that unpleasant, we want to fix it, we want to get rid of it, we want to push it away. And we react to, and these, our reaction to the unpleasant feelings we have, that's the cause of the anger. The person, what the person said, was the condition for the strong unpleasant feeling. The motivated response of anger is our reaction to the unpleasant sensations we have. If we can feel the unpleasantness as unpleasant in an open, mindful way, it doesn't have to translate to being angry. It can translate to a response of trying to take care of it in a responsible way, but it doesn't have to be anger. So here we have a two-part step, or three parts, you know. Someone says something, strong unpleasant feeling, and then anger from us. As opposed to a two-part step, someone said something, anger. If it's a two-part step, it's easy to blame the person. If it's a three-part step that goes through you, through this unpleasant step, it's harder to blame the other person. Make sense? So this idea, you know, what does it strike inside of you? And so sometimes what it strikes, the world, is it strikes our self-identity, the idea, the concept, how we want to represent ourselves to ourselves. So when some of these people at this last retreat who had this very strong feeling that they're not enough, one of the things that, I remember telling one, you are enough. And, I don't know if I said it that way, but I said, you know, that's not true, or that's not a useful statement. You know, I kind of said something like that. I forget what it was wiser than what I said. It was wiser than what I'm telling you, but because I don't remember what I said. certainly wiser than that. But for the purposes of the teaching today, said, you know, you are enough. And that was met with resistance. Met with resistance. No way, I'm not going to accept that. Pushing that back on me. No, you don't understand. So what is it? So they say, what is things meet inside of you? And what happens if there's nothing inside of you that meets it? Nothing hard, nothing fixed. Just let the experience of the world, people say, in some ways, go right through. Or that's just one way. It's a metaphor, doesn't it? Or a metaphor, just dwelling, just it's there in space, empty and expansive. What happens if our mind is so big and so spacious, there's room for everything? If our mind is contracted and claustrophobic and something comes along, then it has to jostle for space inside of us and things have to kind of, you know, are threatened. But if our awareness is really big and spacious, not so much so that we then become vacant people, but then other capacities that we have can respond to the situation. If we're tight, if we're stuck, if we're contracted, then the capacities to respond become much more limited. If we become relaxed, at ease, our creativity becomes stronger. If we become relaxed and at ease, our empathy is more available. If we have relaxed and at ease, then we have more easy access to our wisdom and our common sense to the situation. So if a strong attached idea of self, self-clinging, is like a fist, it has its usefulness, a strong contracted sense of self, idea of self, just like a fist has a usefulness in a certain situations. But a fist, you know, often how it's used is not so helpful to others, you know, and it's kind of frightening to see someone going around with a fist, but it still might have its use. And when my kids were small, one of the not good uses of a fist was to play the game with them trying to pry my fingers apart. And somehow that was lots of fun for them. But once the hand is open, the hand is much more useful. It can be used for many, many things. It can be, you can pick something up in a way you can't if you keep it in a fist. You could shake someone's hand. You can stroke someone at the back of a child's head. You can feel the breeze against the hand. The soft, sensitive part of the hand can feel many more things. There's so much more that you can do than if the hand, the fist is protected in the fist. So the same thing with this tight, constricted sense of self is that it limits us. As the constriction releases, and we don't have to be any particular kind of self. We don't have to be anybody for anything, for anybody. We have to be anybody for anybody. Then it's like the open hand. Who we are becomes much more fluid, flexible, available, multifunctional. So much more is possible in that kind of state. And in that possibility, if you're someone who's developed a path, you become someone who becomes self-confident, someone who becomes capable and strong in a variety of ways. Even though, so the last thing I'll say is that, so there's kind of a juxtaposition because of the maybe difficulty of language or my difficulty with language, is that it's you can almost say the person, someone who's well-developed in this practice has a very strong sense of self, without there being a self there. So if you emphasize one side of that statement more than the other, then you get the wrong impression. But if you hold them together, I think you get closer to the right impression of how it all is. So if ever you get confused again or hear someone confused about this not-self teaching in Buddhism, I hope this talk clarifies it or offers you a different perspective that that we do have a strong functional self in this practice, but it's one that's free. Okay, so maybe we have a couple of minutes. I'm curious if there's any questions, protests.
More like a comment. You talked a little bit about conceit, fear of conceit because of the self. I always saw conceit as a sign of insecurity.
Could well be.
Not of strength. Because if you have the kind of sense of self that you were talking about, you don't need to convince anybody else about how smart, wonderful, whatever you are.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I've seen a lot of conceit, which is insecurity, for sure. But I've seen people who just seem to be incredibly arrogant and secure in their arrogance, and secure in themselves. and usually it's people I'm thinking of are people who are really smart. Not all smart people, right, this way, but I've known people who have been really smart, really capable, and have this inner self-confidence that it's kind of arrogance. So everyone else doesn't count because they know what's going on. They couldn't care less about other people. But, you know, they're secure enough. So I've seen that as well. But, you know, you could say maybe deep down inside there's insecurity, but I haven't seen it in them. Well, you know, but you're right. Often that's the case. What's also interesting is, you know, I think many of you know this already, but it's worth saying that in Buddhism there's three kinds of conceit. There's the conceit that you're better than others. There's a conceit that that you're worse than others or less than others, and there's a conceit that you're equal to others. And all of them have to do with playing the self game. And you have to. And in fact, sometimes people who are extremely shy, paradoxically, have a very strong sense of self. The stronger the shyness, the more the sense of self is quite strong. Self identity. It just takes this particular form around, you know, that shyness. And so then the question is, what's the alternative from seeing yourself as better, worse, or equal to others? And the alternative is don't think any of them. You know, live your life without having to compare yourself to other people. Don't play the comparison game. Just be there. And then I'll end with, at this retreat that I was at, John Travis read a quote. One of the teachers read this quote. It was something like, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but it's thinking less about yourself. Spending less time thinking about yourself. Okay, so thank you all very much. And so we have this wonderful fair that people in our community who volunteer at different things in the community, wider community, have set up these tables and they're available to talk. And don't think that they're trying to recruit you. Show up with enough self-confidence that and assured in yourself that you don't have to worry about if they are. Just be there, because it's just very interesting to see what they do and find out, you know, what makes them, you know, what attracts them to that work. And so please look around and see what our community does. Thank you.